Some young lads were crossing the Cornish moors late at night after an evening of sampling the local beer. They come across one of the many sinkholes in the area, and one of the lads suggests that they throw a rock in to hear how deep the hole is from the consequent splash. They only have one torch between them, and so they scout around in the dark for a suitable projectile. One of them finds a largish rock and throws it into the hole. They hear a strange slithering sound, and then in the light of the torch beam, they see the flash of the face of the most startled goat in Cornwall as he flies through the air, disappears down the hole, attached by rock to the rope to the rock. Judith and I are clearing out the accumulated detritus of 34 years, more or less, living in the same house, and that was one of the stories I discovered from an old email. It has nothing to do with the sermon. I thought it was too good just to leave in the pile. So to business. I'm going to need some water, Brother Phil. It's probably been there a month. Oh, it's changed every Wednesday. The water has changed every Wednesday and blessed every Sunday. Good. I won't die then. Okay, so to business. Where this is the next in the series on the book of Nehemiah, and if you've been keeping count, and I have, this is episode 5 in the series. So a little backstory first of all. How did we get here, or how did Nehemiah get here? Everything went bad for the Jews in Jerusalem in the year 587 BC. The king of Persia at the time, Nebuchadnezzar, destroyed the city, he turned the temple into rubble, and he shipped half the population off to Babylon. Now that was the time of Daniel and Jeremiah, the time of Shadrach, Meshach and Abednego, the time of lions and people living through a fiery furnace, and the king dreaming about a big tree. Now 28 years later, in 559 BC, there's a new king in Persia. His name is Cyrus, and he allows some of the Jews to go back to Jerusalem. He agrees to help them rebuild the temple. You can read a long list of all the people who were in this party in the first chapter of Ezra, which is the book before Nehemiah in the Bible. Now, all told, 42,360 people went back, plus, and this is interesting, 7,337 servants and 200 singers who were apparently not qualified to be thought of as people. Now, there was a lot of political opposition to the rebuilding of the temple. Listening to the Australian government and the mining companies deliver their different spins on the proposed super profits tax reminded me of all the lies and distortions that we were told about the Jews at the same time when they were rebuilding the temple. Same technique, different century. Anyway, the job got done in 516 BC, and that meant it had taken 43 years to rebuild the temple. Then about 60 years further on, the new king of Persia, Artaxerxes, commissions Ezra in the year 457 BC to go to Jerusalem as a kind of governor. And 21 years after that, we come to Nehemiah. So a lot of people think that there was just one return of people from Babylon to Jerusalem, but actually it happened over about a century. Now Nehemiah, when he was in Babylon, had a job as the sommelier to the king of Persia. That is, he tastes the wine and recommends it, or not, to the king. And since the town of Shiraz is in Persia, it's considered to be the place where the Shiraz grape comes from originally, you would think that being the wine taster to the king of Persia would be a rather pleasant occupation. Would Your Excellency prefer the 455 BC Shiraz or the 453 BC Shiraz? Name your poison, sire. Well, maybe not, because Nehemiah wasn't a real sommelier. He was just the guy who tasted the king's wine to make sure it wasn't poisoned. Ken explained this to us a few weeks ago. Anyway, it does seem that Nehemiah's willingness to risk his life at every regal meal endeared him to the king, and this soon proves useful because Nehemiah hears that things aren't going well in Jerusalem, And as we heard in previous weeks, Nehemiah is given the job of rebuilding phase two, that is, rebuilding the wall around Jerusalem. And he goes to Jerusalem in chapter 2, and he starts to build the wall in chapter 3, and in chapter 4 he faces some opposition and gets over it, and that brings us to chapter 5, which we read today. If you want to follow what I'm talking about this morning, you'll find it on page 440 of the Pew Bibles. Now, this chapter 5 is an interesting sidebar to the saga of the wall rebuilding, because it's really not about the wall at all. In chapter 5, we have the story of two side issues that Nehemiah has to confront. First, he has to deal with an issue of injustice within his own ranks. He has to stop the rich and powerful from oppressing the poor and vulnerable. And secondly, we get an insight into Nehemiah's humility and generosity, two characteristics, I believe, of the most effective leaders then and today. In the first instance, the instance of injustice, the problem appears to be caused by the inequality between the people who've just arrived back from Babylon and the ones that have been there for quite some time. The earlier arrivals, of course, have got hold of the best bits of land. And I've been to Jerusalem, and I can tell you there aren't too many best bits of land in Jerusalem. And the later arrivals are forced to rent or live on other people's land to try to grow food. But the new arrivals can't make ends meet, and they end up selling family members into slavery. Well, when Nehemiah hears that this is going on, he's appalled. Actually, it says in verse 6, "When I heard their outcry and these charges, I was very angry." Now, maybe "very angry" doesn't quite catch the strength of the original words here, because he was ablaze with anger. He was furious. He was spitting chips. But note what verse 7 says. It says, "I pondered them in my mind and then accused the nobles and officials." I pondered them in my mind and then accused. What a wonderful lesson in how to deal with injustice. They say the first rule of spanking is that we should never hit a child in anger. Well, a confession time from an old parent. When times were different, I have to say the only time I ever spanked children was when I was angry. If I'd have been able to get a hold of my anger, I probably would have thought of a better alternative that would have been more effective. Well, Nehemiah counts to 10. He lets his anger subside before he accused. What wonderful self-control. Now, as the Star Trekkers amongst you will know, there's an old Klingon proverb that goes, "Revenge is a dish best served cold." Revenge is a dish best served cold. Those Klingons knew a thing or two, apparently. If you think I'm making that up, it really was in the television series. And if there's anybody who thinks that's actually true, it's a joke. Because somebody came up to me after the 8 o'clock sermon and said, "You know, I've heard that proverb from somewhere else. I don't think the Klingons wrote it." I said, "Okay, no, I think you're right." I didn't point out the Klingons don't really exist, but never mind. But it's a good proverb. Revenge is a dish best served cold. Allow the heat of anger to cool down and let wisdom get to work before you act. Isn't the ability to control our anger a wonderful asset? I think we've got a couple of patched holes in the plaster walls at home from a couple of boys who in preteen days had more anger than control. And I was one parent who spanked each subsequent child less and less often as time went by. Now, that was a consequence of my anger management improving rather than their behaviour improving, I have to say. Anyway, I listened to Julia Gillard's Question Time this week, the first one she did on Thursday, was it? Anyone not notice we have a new Prime Minister? I was wonderfully impressed by this woman's self-control. No matter how much the opposition goaded her, she remained cool. No matter how much they said nasty and outrageously distorted things about the proposition they were putting to her, our new Prime Minister politely thanked the opposition member for the question. I reckoned I could hear her just counting to 10 as she was doing that. And then she responded with a witty remark and followed by an answer which, as usual for a politician, had very little to do with the question. But anger, no, not a spark of anger. And this is a characteristic of Nehemiah's leadership style that I reckon we can all learn from. Don't react out of anger. Instead, act out of wisdom. So, having paused to ponder, Nehemiah then accuses the unjust oppressors within the community. And he makes a stunning comparison. He points out that the new arrivals have come back from slavery in Babylon, only to find themselves enslaved by their own kin here in Jerusalem. And it's a comparison which none of them could respond to. They stood there like rebuked children. They stood there like stunned mullets. And then they agreed he was right. They promised to repay those they'd ripped off, and they said amen. And it says in verse 13... the people did as they had promised. Wow. The people did as they had promised. Am I the only one who finds this a bit too good to be true? I reckon Julia Gillard should be getting Nehemiah to negotiate with the miners. He tells them they're wrong. They agree. They do as they're told. Amazing. How could this happen? It's a Jedi mind game, right? There are no Jedi here. And they just do it. No, I don't think that's the way it happened. I think it's because leaders have two kinds of authority. There's one kind of authority called position authority, which comes from the fact that you have a position. And there's another kind of authority called personal authority that you get because of who you are. Position authority comes from the authority you have because of the position you hold. Most of us believe that a chief executive has, by definition, more authority than a male clerk, although I think Generation Y might be challenging this convention these days. When a leader says, I'm the boss and I'm telling you to do it, well, the leader's just using their position authority, or at least they're trying to use it in any case. And I'm sure all of us have had bosses like this. Maybe quite a few of us have worked for these kinds of bosses, the kind who just rely solely on the authority of their position. And they think that this position gives them the right to tell everybody else what to do. I call them tin generals. Well, the best research of the last couple of decades has demonstrated that position authority is a weak kind of authority. Sometimes it does produce good short-term results, but the effect of position authority has a short shelf life. It's got a use-by date somewhere not far beyond bananas. It doesn't last very long. And the reasons it doesn't work are pretty clear. No one likes being bossed around. We don't like somebody just to issue orders to us. And if we have to suffer these kind of leaders, we won't suffer them for long. Staff leave. The organisation starts to suffer because there's this constant revolving door of staff. Knowledge goes out the door with every staff departure, and time is wasted training all the new people as they come in. And as a result, organisational efficiency drops because you're not doing the core business as much. Profits disappear, and soon enough the board's going to call the boss into account, and then, well, you know, they'll give him a golden handshake and he'll go off to Portofino with his girlfriend. Position authority doesn't get the job done. Not by itself, anyway. The other kind of authority is personal authority. Now, this is the kind of authority that comes from who the leader is, how the leader behaves, how the leader relates to other people. And it's no accident that the second half of chapter 5, which we almost read first, shows us something really important about Nehemiah's personal authority. In contrast to the exploiters within their ranks, Nehemiah is generous. He's not an ivory tower leader who sits behind a big desk in the corner office. For the 12 years he worked with the people, apparently he worked as a volunteer. It's not exactly clear where Nehemiah got his money from. Some commentators suggest that he must have saved up all those shekels during his time checking the king's wine for hemlock, and maybe he was well rewarded, or maybe the king just gave him enough money that he could go ahead, he had enough for his own provisions and to provide for others. But what is clear is that as governor, he was entitled to receive a tax from the people together with food and wine for his consumption. And previous governors, it says, had taxed the people 40 shekels of silver each. Now, if you notice at the bottom of the Pew Bibles, they actually tell you what a shekel is, although there's a fair amount of doubt about this, but it says that it's about half a kilo, 460 grams. It's a measure of weight. So if you reckon on what the value of silver is today, should ask Peter Beaver this, but I looked it up, and a half, and it's about, that 40 shekels is worth about $400 in today's terms, 40 shekels of silver. Now, I reckon there must have been about 70,000 people living in Jerusalem at the time, because there were about 50 that came over with Ezra, maybe more. If you do the math, and I did, he would get an annual income of $28 million in today's money. It's a bit more than Ken's salary. It's more than mine. Anyone else getting $28 million this year? Because if you are, there's a building project that needs your support. Well, I don't know if it really was $28 million, because we really don't know for sure what a shekel weighed, and we don't know what the value of silver really was in those days, and we don't really know how many people paid the tax. You know, it might have just been taxed per one family, not per person. But the point is that Nehemiah was entitled to this, and he didn't take the entitlement. Not one shekel. Not one bit of food or wine for his table. On the contrary, he fed the people and lent them money when they needed it. Now, more than that, he went to work on the wall, just like everybody else. All his men were assembled there for the work, it says in verse 16. Don't you love a boss who's not too proud to do the work? Now, when I arrived at my present job, I was blessed with a personal assistant. I didn't ask for a personal assistant, but she was there and I got her anyway. I didn't think chief executives of medium-sized businesses like ours had personal assistants in the 21st century. I hadn't had one for 10 years or more. But anyway, there she was, and she was going to organise my life for me. Well, after a couple of weeks, I noticed that we had a roster for stacking the dishwasher in the staff lunchroom. I checked the names on it and found only one name was missing. Mine. I suggested to my personal assistant that she might like to add my name to the list. After all, I said, I could stack and did stack and unstack a dishwasher at home. I was quite talented. She might like to imagine that I could probably do this at work too. Oh, Mr. Hunt, she said. She called me Mr. Hunt, which might tell you something. Oh, Mr. Hunt, we can't have the boss doing the housework, she said with a shocked look on her face. Well, I said, I don't think we can have the boss not doing the housework. So very reluctantly, she put my name on the list. In the end, I have to tell you that she was smarter than me. Whenever I went to stack the dishwasher during my week, I found she'd already beaten me to it. Of course, the point I was trying to make to her was that people watch their leaders all the time. And one of the most powerful things a leader can do is to model right behaviour to the team. Too many leaders follow the do as I say, not as I do rule. Yet the most powerful influence on an organisation's culture is the example the boss lives for the team to see. Regrettably, this point that I was trying to model in an inclusive team approach to work was entirely lost on my personal assistant. It led to her early retirement. Well, Nehemiah had more influence than me over his assistants. He positioned himself as one member of a team engaged in a clearly focused endeavour, which was rebuilding the wall. Therefore, he worked on the wall like he wanted everyone else to do. And that's why he succeeded as a leader, a great leader. His personal authority grew with every selfless act of support for the people, and his personal authority reinforced and validated his position authority. So I reckon that's the message of chapter 5 of Nehemiah. It's a lesson about what leaders should concern themselves with. In this case, the welfare of the people first, and the power of modelling the right behaviour as a leader. It's easy to think of leaders who don't model right behaviour. Regrettably, it's easy. But let's not scapegoat bad leaders. Instead, we should see that Nehemiah was a precursor, a forerunner of the kind of leader who would demonstrate more than anyone before or since the difference between position and personal authority. One who, although he was in very nature God, did not consider equality with God something to be grasped, but humbled himself, taking on the very nature of a servant. Jesus. Jesus' impact on our world comes less from his position than on the way he behaved. Yes, he was God, but that's not what impresses us. We follow him because he became like us. Jesus became like Nehemiah, one of the people. He humbled himself and became obedient to death. I always find it interesting that much eternal truth is in the Bible that gets rediscovered later. You know, there's a fundraising exercise hidden away in 2 Corinthians chapters 8 and 9. It exhibits all the hallmarks of modern fundraising, the eternal truths of how to run a good fundraising campaign, and it was all written down about 2,000 years ago. Just a few years ago, extensive research by Professor Jim Collins and his students defined the kind of leaders that create sustainable success in organisations, the kind of leaders that turn good organisations into great organisations. He wrote a book called Good to Great. He called these leaders level 5 leaders. He was describing exactly the kind of leadership that we see in Nehemiah and Jesus. You see, the Bible's a pretty useful book. I commend it to you.